The views expressed on The Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. You can also note that we are now podcasting on iTunes. If you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show or any of the shows, you're free to do so. Just send us an email so we know that you're doing it. If you'd like to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.
Brandon Baxter, Connor Stevens, Doug Wright, and Joshua Skelly Stafford were arrested on April 30th, 2012 for attempting to blow up a bridge with provocation of an FBI informant named Shaquille Azir. More about the case can be found at cleveland4solidarity.org. Following this, we speak with volunteers from the nonprofit radical media outlet Unicorn Riot. Unicorn Riot has done an amazing job of featuring dazzling on-the-ground coverage of struggles such as those following the police murders of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile in the Minneapolis area, also around the violent removal of homeless settlements in Denver, and the ongoing struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, or DAPL, in North Dakota. Their work can be found at unicornriot.ninja. Lots got trimmed from this episode due to time constraints, so check out the podcast version at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. Tomorrow, Monday, December 5th in Asheville, there's a prayer and vigil in solidarity with Standing Rock as regards the struggle to stop the expansion of DAPL that we'll be talking about later on in this episode briefly. Folks are meeting at PAX Square at 6 p.m. Bring an offering. Also, big ups to the folks who went out to face off with the KKK motorcade on Saturday the 3rd in Danville, Virginia and Pelham, North Carolina. At least this time, the KKK got their own stabby.
But before the interview, here are some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? We're caught like a wolf! Today is Fidel Castro's funeral. In the 1950s, Fulgencio Batista ruled Cuba as the dictator, occasionally allowing rigged elections. Batista and the ruling elite of Cuba thrived on American bribes, turning their island into a Caribbean Las Vegas. The population lived short, cruel lives with the highest infant mortality rate and the lowest literacy rate in the hemisphere. After one particularly obviously fixed election, a young upstart lawyer named Fidel Castro challenged the results. When that failed, Castro set his mind on orchestrating a revolution. He joined a group that laid siege to the Moncada barracks, hoping to gain access to the armory and to arm the Cuban people, toppling the Batista regime. Moncada failed, and Castro was sent to prison for life. At his sentencing, Castro issued a firebrand declaration that concluded with a prescient prediction that history would vindicate him. After years in prison, Castro was released when someone bribed Batista, and Castro was sent into exile in Mexico, where he met up with a revolutionary Cuban expatriate group and an Argentine named Che Guevara. Castro immediately set his mind again to toppling Batista. Castro's crew attempted to buy a PT boat so they could sail to Cuba and undertake guerrilla warfare, but the deal for the boat fell through. With no other options, the group purchased a yacht from a Cuban expat retired in Mexico. Castro and friends crammed more than 100 people onto that yacht with food and water for the journey. The plan was to rendezvous with a contingent in Cuba who would have weapons waiting on the beach. But nobody checked the weather first, so they sailed directly into a hurricane. Because the yacht was sailing so heavy with more than 100 people, it took on water, The salt water shorted out the electricity, killing all navigation and refrigeration. So they sailed blind, and all their food spoiled. In the days that Castro and his crew sailed in circles out in the ocean, patrols discovered the contingent on the Cuban beach and arrested them and confiscated all their guns. The Cuban military waited in ambush. When Castro's crew finally figured out where they were and sailed toward Cuba, they were starving and dehydrated and hurricane-weary. As they approached the island, planes flew over, dropping bombs. Soldiers fought. In response, the revolutionaries panicked and ran aground on a sandbar, stranded 100 yards from shore. So under fire and with bombs dropping from the sky, the 100-plus guerrillas dove into the ocean and swam for the beach. In the chaos that followed, most of the survivors ran up the beach and into the jungle and found their way back to their respective homes, resuming their non-revolutionary lives. But not all. A local farmer discovered a handful of cold and shivering, hungry people wandering in the jungle around his farm. Since it was raining season, the farmer brought those wandering guerrillas to his barn and gave them food and blankets. There were 12 of them. They had 4 operable firearms between them and very little ammunition. They were exhausted and cold and wet, and their leader, the brains of this operation, was a failed revolutionary who had already been sent to prison once and had sailed them into a hurricane and into a sandbar and into failure after failure. There, in that barn, the 12 of them had to decide what to do moving forward. They decided to load their 4 weapons and wage irregular warfare against a mechanized and technologically advanced military of 80,000 soldiers that had the full backing of the United States government. 18 months later, Fulgencio Batista fled Havana and went into exile with a suitcase full of cash. What began with 12 shivering, hapless dreamers in a barn ended with the toppling of a tyrant. The significance of the Cuban Revolution is that at no time did the guerrilla forces number more than 5,000. It occurred just miles off of the shore of Florida. And, as an example for us, the Cuban Revolution proved that we don't have to wait for conditions in order to instigate or provoke rebellion. That once an insurrection begins, it becomes contagious. What Castro and those revolutionaries accomplished in ousting a dictator can be duplicated by Zapatistas in Mexico, or Sandinistas in Nicaragua, or by you and me right here, right now. Political violence works. Want to change the world? You only need 12 guerrillas, 4 guns, and a yacht. Now, all that said, Castro was a hierarch. So after leading the rebellion that successfully ousted a dictator, Castro ceased being a guerrilla and assumed the swivel chair behind the former dictator's desk. As a head of state, Castro can be criticized for political repression and for not allowing elections, although much of that was influenced greatly by the constant threat of U.S. interference and sabotage. Had Castro permitted free elections, the CIA would have funded an electoral coup. But Castro, the head of state, is not the example that speaks to all of us. I think we can easily distinguish between Castro the guerrilla, who opposed the existing power through political violence, and the later disappointing Castro, who became the existing power. Castro the rebel stared down a ruthless terror state and declared that history would vindicate him. May history vindicate us as well. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Warren Correctional Institution, Lebanon, Ohio. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio 45036. For updates on his situation and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
I'm speaking with Amanda Shemkes, a legal supporter for the Cleveland Four, and in particular for Brandon Baxter. Thanks a lot for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
So many people in the audience may not be familiar with the case of the Cleveland Four, despite it being such a recent one. Who are the Four, and can you tell folks a little bit about their stories?
Yeah, so the four are Brandon Baxter, Connor Stevens, Doug Wright, and Josh Stafford, who's also known as Skelly. And they were four Occupy Cleveland activists who were caught up in being entrapped by the FBI. The FBI had a paid informant who spent months manipulating them into a plot that he created, and that the government supplied fake explosives to blow up a bridge. And they then were prosecuted as terrorists for this, even though it's something that never would have happened if not for a government informant crafting the whole thing and pressuring them into it.
And so just to lay out a little more deeply, can you talk a little bit about, like, do you know the situations that they were in when they got involved with the confidential informant, the Shaquille Azir? Like, I had heard that they were all, like, basically, like, a small crew of anarchists, that some of which were, like, influenced by Catholic worker and stuff, and they were doing food dot bombs and mostly kind of living on the streets and off of food donations, and kind of got taken under Shaquille Azir's wing, right?
Yes, very much so. It was, he started to really start talking to them at the end of Occupy, when things had started to fall apart, and we saw that happening nationally, where Occupy encampments, the government basically decided that it was time for them to end, and they effectively put an end to them. And so people, especially these four people, were lost at that point, trying to figure out what to do. They had been living at the encampment. They'd been doing, as you said, food not bombs work, trying to build relationships with the community, trying to take care of people, interested in doing more demonstrations, trying to be more effective in doing those demonstrations. And they were also dealing with a lot of their own personal issues, battling addiction, dealing with mental health issues. And so for a lot of reasons, just in very vulnerable points when Azir came in and preyed upon that and took their wanting to try and do more, to be more effective in challenging, the evil forces of capitalism. And he exploited that and tried to manipulate them in different ways, as they were talking about wanting to have more effective demonstrations, to have better gear for going out to demonstrations and things like that. He's the one who started introducing ideas of explosives.
And so he was also at this point, like, providing them with employment opportunities, as well as drugs and alcohol, money, support, almost like a father figure type thing.
Very much so. He was promising them places to live and things like that. Something that I don't know how much has been publicized about the case is that a lot of the conversations that he was having with them were as he was driving them to work. He was in the business of flipping houses, and so he was having them work on his houses. And so a lot of these conversations were as he's driving them to job sites and then at job sites. So it wasn't just that they were talking to someone who was someone else who they thought was from the community or something. He was very much taking on that role of father figure, and they saw him as his boss that they were having these conversations with. So he was, there were all kinds of power dynamics that he was exploiting through these relationships.
The steps in the actual case, they were picked up on the 30th of April in 2012 for having attempted to place these fake explosives that were purchased through Shaquille Azir from FBI agents who are undercover at the base of this bridge outside of Cleveland to make a big impact on capitalism on May 1st, right?
Yeah.
And then they went back to a restaurant and one of them attempted to explode the bridge, and it didn't. And then they were picked up there. Can you talk a little bit about what their case looked like from that point on?
Yeah, from that point, I mean, they were very much dealing with being prosecuted as terrorists. We've seen, like, the large trend of that since 9/11, where the government has been going after these terrorism prosecutions and, you know, wanting to create this idea that the government is keeping us safe from terrorists. But these are not the only people who have been entrapped through government-created plots. So the government creates this idea of terrorism that was going to happen, and then the government swooping in as the heroes and putting an end to it. And so we need to look at the framework and that broader scope and looking at how the government is manufacturing terrorism so that then they can show that they are putting an end to it. And it's ridiculous and needs to be questioned. And these people, the Cleveland Four, in their cases, got to unfortunately experience that at that very personal level going through, as soon as they were arrested, being put in solitary confinement, not having a lot of access to court resources, not having a lot of legal support, struggling to have community support.
They had the whole world against them is what it felt like. And the government, like, you make the good point of saying that the government, like, set up in this case and has in a number of other circumstances, including and mostly against Muslim Americans, has set up these cases where somebody was angry about something, and so this informant steps in and is like, oh, well, yeah, I'm angry about that too. You're not angry enough, though. Let's go do some stuff. And like, oh, here, I can get you this stuff. And like, just kind of plants the seeds, provides the supposed opportunities, which are oftentimes through their FBI handlers and faked to make sure that the circumstance goes out safely. But where, as I understand, the Four, when they talked about upping the ante and like taking radical action from that next step, wasn't necessarily anything that was going to threaten human safety. It was symbolic actions like damaging signs outside of banks, blowing up bank signs, maybe. When Shaquille Azir introduces the idea of like, no, that's not enough. We need to up the ante and we need to get like big explosives and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can look at like throughout his time with them, they were talking about wanting things like gear to wear to protest because cops are using violent tactics, and they were wanting things like paint bombs or maybe pepper spray, things like that, that are definitely a different realm of things than talking about explosives. And they repeatedly also expressed that they didn't want to hurt anyone, even when, you know, talk started to form about the bridge. Multiple times they were trying to back out of it. They were asking questions about, you know, when would people not be on the bridge? So always expressing that interest in not hurting people, but that just wanting to find ways to impact capitalism.
And this is within like the framework for people who are listening. Like you said, it's the end of Occupy, which is this very like vaguely populist time. A lot of people got radicalized through this period. And these are young, passionate people who very much want to help people through their activism and through their charity work. And this is Cleveland, which is kind of a like dire, deindustrialized Midwestern city in the Rust Belt. Just having gone through year four of its most recent, like, and the national, economic depression that was going on, just like painting that picture, or like in my head when I put those elements in there, it just like creates this dire situation. And like, no wonder these kids, these young men, were angry and were incited and wanted to do something, and it just took this person working on behalf of the federal government to have them say some stupid stuff and plan to do something that was really stupid, especially through peer pressure.
Yeah, and even Brandon, I know in particular with some of what you just talked about, his dad's house was in the process of being foreclosed on as this was going on, and Azir was offering to help his dad get out of that situation. So even at that very core personal level, he was manipulating them based on their family circumstances at this rough financial time.
That's crazy. So initially there were five people. So Anthony Haney took a cooperating plea. Can you talk a little bit about how the court case went through and for the four of them?
So Brandon, Connor, and Doug, they took non-cooperating plea deals. But, you know, a lot of times when we look at plea deals, it's people working with the prosecutor ahead of time to work out exactly what the sentence is going to be, and knowing that going into signing the plea deal and agreeing to it. But with theirs, it was just that they were pleading guilty and then going before the judge and seeing what the sentence would be. So they were walking into that in a very scary situation, knowing that, you know, it could have been life basically for what they were accused of doing. But they got sentences, all around a decade, give or take a year or so, and then supervised release for the rest of their lives. So that means probation forever for them. And that's because of the terrorism enhancement that was placed on these cases. With the terrorism enhancement, judges have the discretion to make supervised release anywhere from zero to life, and the judge gave them life. So clearly on the extreme high end of that. So people who, you know, being arrested when they're around 20 years old and then going to prison for a decade and then looking at being on probation for the rest of their life. And then Josh, he decided to take his case to trial, which, as we could probably expect, didn't go well. It never goes well when people are accused of terrorism. You know, the public has very strong ideas around that word. And so trial did not go well for him, and he ended up with similar sentences to the rest of them.
Did he get the terrorist enhancement also?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's why they all have the supervised release for the rest of their lives.
Fast forward, I guess. Can you talk a little bit about the circumstances of their incarceration? Like, how are they getting on, and what sort of facilities are they in, and how long do they have left of their sentences?
Yeah, so they all have at least a few years left in prison, and they've all had a rough time. They've done long stretches in the SHU. Right now, currently, Connor and Josh are both in the SHU. Brandon also was just recently, but then he was let out. So definitely a rough time for all of them. And a big part of why they need that continued support from people. They've, you know, all been in prison now for over 4 years. And a lot of times in cases like this, there's a lot of support in the beginning when, you know, there's a lot of fresh media attention. And, you know, people feel a lot of support in the first year or so, but now it's been longer and there needs to be that continued support for them, especially as they do continue to feel very isolated when they are put in the SHU and when they're in some very rough facilities and when they are looking towards a pretty daunting rest of their sentence.
For listeners that may not be aware, can you describe what the SHU is, what security housing is, what it looks
yeah.
like?
Yeah, so that's when people are taken out of general population. They are kept in a cell for usually 23 hours a day, and they don't have as much access to commissary and other things, and they are just very isolated. And there's been study after study showing that when people are placed in the SHU, especially for, you know, more than a week or two, that it very much impacts their mental functioning. Contributes to depression, contributes to suicidal thoughts, contributes to a lot of anxiety, and can have a permanent impact on people's brains that can take a very long time to recover from. And we've seen even politicians have spoken out against solitary confinement in this form. And it's something that, you know, there needs to be that continued push to not, for no one to ever be in that circumstance, let alone ever be in prison. And so it's been very rough on them, especially since they were experiencing a lot of mental health issues, even going into prison. And then the SHU can very much exacerbate things like that.
Can you talk a little bit about, like, your relationship with Brandon and if you have much mm-hmm. of one with the other folks? Like, what kind of personalities are they? Like, I know that Connor is a pretty prolific writer and has mm-hmm. turned to Islam in the last few years and has a pretty, like, esoteric mind, it seems like. But what are their personalities like?
Yeah, so I mostly know Brandon. I've been doing legal work for him for the last several months and gotten to know him on a personal level too through doing that. And he is a very intelligent, compassionate person who's been using his time in prison to figure out what he can do to help people more when he gets out. Even while in prison, he's, you know, been doing things like tutoring people, helping people with legal issues. He's learning Spanish. He wants to be able to start a nonprofit organization when he gets out to help low-income people. So just he has had a very rough time and has, you know, had some very dark moments in that. But he is trying to hold on to that goodness and that hope. And wanting to be able to continue to just help people and has such a big heart through all of this. The other three, I don't know on a personal level. I've mostly just gotten to know a bit about them through learning more about the case. And I am just repeatedly struck by how this is a group of people who are just, you know, trying to search for ways to want to make good change in the world. And now these are the situations they're in. And the whole case is just heartbreaking. The more I learn about it, the more heartbreaking it feels.
I think it's really important. Like, we've already sort of framed this in terms of this stuff was going on during Occupy, but all this was, like, I think all this was timed by the government to undermine the Occupy as an the Occupy movement nationally as an anti-capitalist, or at least like movement challenging capitalism, when anarchism was a philosophy that was coming back into the popular mindset to occur on May Day. During the NATO protests, like nearby in Chicago, and to just sort of like increase the national policing mandate in the domestic war on terror. So, I mean, the timing was perfect to have this wider swath, and these individuals like were a part of this wider anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian movement. And I think it's really important for us to, yeah, like you say, make them know that they're not forgotten. Reframe the narratives around use of force. And also, I think it's a continued challenge that's always going to be there when we're going to have the state trying to undermine our organizing and undermine our communities, to be out there making sure that there are no more Cleveland Fours.
Yeah. I mean, we have to remember, too, that, you know, the age-old tactic that the government uses is to divide movements. To pick out people to paint as extremists and make everyone else want to distance themselves from them, because then you have this, like, quote, like, mainstream, like, acceptable movement that the government is fine with because it's not challenging anything real. And then the people who are labeled as the extremists get cast aside, they get forgotten, and we need to work to not let those divisions happen, to recognize that, you know, there needs to be diversity of tactics. There need to be different perspectives. There need to be those internal discussions about how to move forward and to most effectively challenge the powers that be. And that we just need to have we all need to have a stronger understanding of how the government uses those tactics against us and to divide us and to organize in ways in which we can counter that.
So, Amanda, you mentioned letter writing as a way of supporting the Four. Can you talk about what other, like, what would you tell to anyone who's listening to this and who's, like, on the fence about, like, well, what can I do to support, like, any of these four men, Brandon, Skelly, Connor, or Doug? What are some steps people can take?
Yeah, so definitely do write letters. That makes such a difference, just hearing from people on the outside to have that connection, for them to hear stories about things. It means so much to them. And you can go on their website. There's the Cleveland4Solidarity.org, and that's the number 4. And on there it has the addresses for the facilities that they're each at. And if you've never written a letter to a prisoner before, like, don't be afraid of it. It can be a little awkward at first to be writing to someone you don't know, but just introduce yourself and go from there, and it can be great relationships to build. And also, donations are really important because it's unfortunately expensive for people to be in prison. You know, if they want to email their friends or family, or call their friends and family, or if they want stamps for their letters, all of that costs money. So donating towards their commissary fund is super important. There's been someone supporting them the whole time through all this who does a lot of work to make sure that each of them get $50 a month on their commissary. But it's a lot of work for a lot of years to be able to raise that $200 a month. So whatever people can donate towards their commissary is amazing. And you can do that through the website or the Facebook page, which is Cleveland for Solidarity. Both have donate buttons that will lead you to being able to do a donation. You can also do things like planning letter writing events. If you're tabling, you can have flyers about them or a jar to collect donations for them. Spread information online. Talk to your friends about their cases. And doing just a lot of work to not only spread awareness about them, but about the bigger political context of their case and why it's so important to support them as well as other prisoners. And also to point out, Connor's birthday is coming up on the 17th, so a birthday card can be a great initial way to get in touch with someone, and I'm sure that it would mean a lot to him to hear from people on his birthday.
Well, any parting thoughts, Amanda?
Just I'd tell people to look more into the circumstances of this case as well as other prisoners. There are so many people out there who need support. And again, the website is clevelandforsolidarity.org. And the guys would all love to hear from people, and they appreciate support so much.
Well, thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw.
We're speaking with Wendy Marlowe and Pat Boyle, members of the Unicorn Riot Media Collective, who are just back from Standing Rock in North Dakota. Unicorn Riot has been a significant media outlet on the front lines coverage of resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota since well before mainstream media stopped ignoring the struggle quite so much. Thanks a lot for taking the time to chat, both of y'all.
Thanks for having us on, Burst.
Definitely.
Yeah, thanks, Burst.
Could you describe Unicorn Riot as a project for listeners that may not be aware of it?
Unicorn Riot is a 501c3 educational media platform. That's our platform. And then all of our content is licensed Creative Commons, non-commercial, share alike, which means that it is free to the public of no charge and free to any other non-commercial entities. Also, we don't take any ad money on our website, which is unicornriot.ninja. So if you go there, you'll notice that all our content is commercial free.
Why did you make that choice, if you just like spell it out?
We chose that because we kind of felt that the problem with media is that, you know, ultimately people are going to be beholden to some sort of corporation or just like ad driven based stuff. So when you're making media and ultimately you're making money from ads, a lot of the stories you're doing are going to be driven by, you know, is this going to be good for the people giving us money to put ads on our website instead of actually getting the story out there? So we felt that it was the most ethical way for us to do this.
Considering the like amount that y'all cover on the ground, how do you cover the costs of maintaining equipment and getting folks, you know, from place to place and feeding them and stuff like that? You said it's a nonprofit. Does anyone get paid?
Yeah, everything is done through donations. You know, we have some people will suddenly make a large donation. Other people are set up to just monthly donate $2 a month to Unicorn Riot. And so we have that set up as a recurring monthly payment. Everyone's working as a volunteer. All of the members originally were using their own equipment. Slowly as donations have come in, we've been able to just slowly branch out in terms of purchasing really essential equipment. And, you know, such as like a phone that has streaming capability that different members can borrow and sort of check out as they need different, like we just got a mobile booster signal for Standing Rock specifically so that people would be able to link up to the internet more easily. And we have been able, as time has gone on, to pay out for travel expenses. So gas, plane tickets, rental cars, and food expenses while people are on the road and traveling to different locations to cover. So yes, everyone is working as a volunteer. However, equipment and travel is funded, and you know, our hosting live stream, things like that are funded by donations.
That is so awesome considering the like the high level of quality that y'all put out. Like I've seen tons of shoestring budget projects where people just, you know, it pretty crappy. But yeah.
Yeah, we did actually just recently get a grant also.
Oh, that's awesome too. And on the website, you're hosting the D program, right? And like live streaming of events and podcasts, as well as hosting like standalone like videos. Yeah.
Yes.
So y'all have been providing some amazing on the ground coverage of numerous struggles around North America since your founding in 2014. In particular, I'm thinking of your coverage of the uprisings in Minneapolis and St. Paul area following the killings of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile in late 2015, mid-2016, respectively, and the ongoing struggle against the DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline. What are some points of conflict that y'all, as a project, have been present for that stand out for you? Maybe I just pointed to two of them.
Yeah, take that one.
Yeah, in Denver, one of the first videos that Pat made was on April 28th, which was a Solidarity with Baltimore action that took place here, where there was just very intense police repression and basically just attacking this march almost instantly. It was you know, odd to see. There had been a few marches in the few days before, but this one was basically put out as more of an anarchist militant focus in terms of Defend Denver, and instantly the police were just attacking the crowd, and it just became, you know, within minutes there were 10 arrests and pepper spraying the crowd and pepper spraying children. And that video went pretty far right away. We were surprised, you know, it's just this kind of shock. So that was just kind of like the start in terms of like Denver's involvement with Unicorn Riot in terms of something really getting out there as a conflict. And then after that, we had started to cover some of the Denver Homeless Out Loud with the tiny homes. There was an action that day to build tiny homes in a park, and there were a lot of arrests that day. And then we also ended up, we heard there was going to be police presence at a small camp of tents that had gone up on the causeway in between the street and the sidewalk. I don't know if causeway is the right word, but the little strip there with grass. And so folks were putting up tents to sleep for the night because there was going to be a pretty bad snowstorm. And Pat and I decided to just stay overnight in his truck because we'd heard the police were coming. And at 6 a.m. they came and started making announcements. And it's, you know, 6 in the morning in the middle of a blizzard, they kicked everyone out of these tents. And it was just really heartbreaking. And we were glad we were there and had made that decision to be there to capture that in the morning and just really be able to highlight for people what is going on in Denver in terms of the homeless sweeps, which consequently we're going to put out a post today. This is starting again. There's been just some massive sweeps starting in Denver where the police are taking homeless people's tents and sleeping bags as evidence and then citing them with the camping ban and giving them tickets for basically just trying to survive in 20 degree weather.
What kind of like outcomes have you seen to the coverage that y'all are giving? Like, it's useful to be there as witness, and also, like, having done cop watch myself, like, I understand, like, just having a camera on cops will sometimes make them act differently if you're visible. But have you seen that sort of pan out, and or have you seen like city council change its methodology because of the impact of the videos getting spread around?
I would say probably no. But Pat, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, you know, it's always going to depend on where you are and what city it is, who, you know, who's in power in that city, as far as like which political party, and, you know, and just like the history of each place. So that's going to like vary from place to place. My experience is that the cops pretty much act the same. I think video, as far as, you know, whether it's someone who just wants to expose police corruption or someone who wants to hold them accountable, I'm not convinced that videotaping is always going to change their behavior, but it definitely does sometimes. But there was a protest against the chief of police conference here in Denver. I think that was like over a year ago now. And I went out to go cover that. And basically got assaulted by police. They arrested me for, I was videotaping, that's all I was doing. But they came at me because I was, you know, in the street. So they tackled me and slammed me into a police car, separated my ribs, and then confiscated my camera for 8 months. And I fought it in court for a while, and then eventually we got him to just basically, I took a plea that I would plead guilty to obstruction if I got no other punishment. So eventually I took that. But you know, that was pretty difficult, and I was videotaping it. They gave me back my footage. They said they would give me all of my footage. And of course the footage that I was taking while a pretty much the hugest riot cop, that works, with DPD was the one that attacked me, and that footage is gone now. So they deleted my footage. So yeah, so I don't know. I mean, maybe they care, maybe they're just going to beat you in the street while you videotape it. It's like, it's really hard to say.
I think too, in terms of, you know, definitely in terms of the homeless sweeps in Denver, I don't see any direct results right now. I think what we do as Unicorn Riot is about just like these stories that are going under the radar, that the mainstream media has such an angle that they come from one way or the other, you know, with all the sensationalism, or just very much on the part of the city and where the money's involved, which is what it's all about anyways, you know, clearing out people where there's no services for them, but they need to be cleared out of town because of the businesses don't want them around, and nobody really has a solution. There just aren't enough beds. There aren't enough shelters in Denver. And I think, to me, what keeps me going is just that constant education piece, that constant view of like, all right, this is what's happening. This is what's continuing to happen. And I think we can't always see the buildup of public awareness or the buildup of outrage, because a lot of times, like right now, no one knows what to do, but people know that it's wrong. And we know that from the number of hits that a story like that gets, shows us that people know that this is wrong. They want to see it and don't know what to do next. And I think as culture, as people, that builds. So it's hard to say where we are along that scale, but I'm willing to just keep telling that story until something can actually be tangibly done about it. It's just hard to measure like what kind of compassion can come in when people hear the real stories of what kind of police repression people of color are facing, you know, to see these homeless people have their sleeping bags taken away. It's just, I think the more people see that, I believe the more compassion people can have for the whole story instead of just having this imagery that they're hit with constantly.
So I guess, would you call y'all's project an activist journalist project, or do you separate those two things?
Okay. This is a great question because it has come up repeatedly, especially in the last few months. And we all, you know, all of us bristle at being referred to as an activist collective, because if we were an activist collective, we would be actively engaging in the struggles. Some of the terms that have come up that have been a little harder to argue with are advocacy journalism or impact journalism, because, you know, there's an obvious angle of what stories we're looking to tell. And there's an obvious sidestepping of the bullshit of like, I don't need to hear the other side of what the police in Standing Rock are doing, because they're fucking liars and they're full of shit. So it's like, yeah, I'll watch their press conference, but I'm not going to just give them this respectful interview because they're fucking lying and it's obvious, and I'm not going to pretend. And that objectiveness, I think, is often a lot of pretending. However, we are, you know, 1,000% committed to telling the truth, to not skewing facts, to not misrepresenting anything. It's just a question of what voice deserves to be on our platform. And that is obviously this angle of struggle, and it would be silly to pretend it isn't. But to be called activist has been frustrating, because I know what that is, to be an activist and to organize and to be in the street and to be actively engaged in something, versus observing, documenting, telling the story, doing the research, is a very different thing. So I think it's been a little confusing, or purposely confusing. These same news organizations that call us an activist collective also then try to steal our footage because they're not there.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, I mean, we don't...
What?
I didn't mean to call you an activist. I'm sorry.
No, you're okay. Fine, Bert. You're fine. Because, I mean, it is confusing because we're clearly not just some, like, you know, just some news organization that's just, you know, reporting on the facts. It's like, obviously, you know, we care. We have intense... there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of passion around it as well.
Yeah. I mean, we don't claim to be objective. You know, I think a lot of us would reject the idea that any journalist could be objective, and that the journalists who claim that they are lying, or just don't really understand that that's like not really possible. So
you mentioned before getting arrested, while covering these events, members of your crew been attacked and arrested. As a radical news source, how do you balance a desire to operate safely in the field with demands for getting the voices of the struggle out to the world. And do you find yourself ever leaning on, like, First Amendment arguments for freedom of the press to legitimate access or legitimate access to, like, the state around treaty-protected indigenous lands and your welcomeness on those lands?
I think for the first part, I was thinking about that question because I think, I mean, no one is – there's never any pressure or any – sort of, I don't know what, like obligation to be anywhere or any, you know, do anything that anyone doesn't feel, you know, 100% comfortable with in terms of being safe. I tend to just go towards, you know, when things are happening and just use my best judgment or my best intuition of where to move in and out of. I wasn't doing any direct filming on the bridge that night. However, at one point I was like right up in the front with the water being sprayed. I was checking on each person who was filming, walked right across the line in between the riot cops and all of the water protectors with their shields to get over to the other side. You know, it's just like, I'm just kind of gauging it minute to minute. At the same time, there was tear gas, there were flashbangs, there were concussion grenades. Within all of that, I had some goggles on and a really, you know, just basic dust mask, which worked minimally. One of the things that came out of that night was we have donations coming in. We decided to use that donation money to order helmets and respirators and as well as some body armor for anyone who wanted it within the collective. And I was like, sure, I will take that for next time. You know, just with the reality of Pat being shot with a rubber bullet and his badge being blasted off and, you know, the reality of the injuries that we found out about throughout the night and the next day, I realized I probably did need a little bit of extra gear, but it is definitely just something, you know, it's a personal choice for each person, how far they're willing to go. These are things we were all doing to begin with anyway. We're just kind of gearing up a little bit more now. And in terms of First Amendment is interesting because Pat was arrested for being in the street and was charged with obstruction of a street, I believe, and for filming a protest. And, you know, in Denver recently at an anti-Trump rally, at the very end of a march, a large group of people went up and ended up on the highway blocking traffic, stopped traffic for about a half hour. And at some point I got up there and made the decision to go over the concrete barrier, you know, knowing that, all right, I am now, you know, I'm filming and I'm documenting. However, I am now going over this concrete barrier and I do put myself at risk. And there was just this Fox News reporter standing there. Suddenly he was just instantly there and reporting with a camera and a microphone and everything, just standing in front of the stopped cars. And I was just struck by that, just, all right, here's this Fox News reporter standing in the middle of the highway. Is he going to be arrested for obstructing the highway? I doubt that very highly. However, with Standing Rock, what we are seeing with Amy Goodman being arrested and what we've seen with our reporters being arrested is that the police definitely have a bias that way in terms of who they think is on their side or not, and who the image of this, you know, classic reporter, I think he was even wearing some sort of like trench coat or something with the camera and the microphone, and how that image carries a certain weight for law enforcement and for the public. And, you know, we're just kind of walking on that line. And so I think in terms of Standing Rock, it feels like both to me. I feel very strongly that as someone who's documenting, I have a right to be there. And I also feel very strongly about the unceded treaty land. So I would say it's both for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing because it's all over the place. Like, for example, I think one time, I don't remember if it was Justice for Jamar or Philando Castile, but Minneapolis Police Department actually flagged down Nico while they were live streaming to make a statement, which was weird.
Whoa.
And they were like, yeah, they were like, hey, we need, it was like right on the highway while everything's going on. So that happened. But then, you know, Morton County sheriffs will be like, oh, you guys aren't journalists, and have even made statements because we're not journalists because we don't portray law enforcement in a favorable light. So that's actually, those are arguments that they've actually like made. And so it's always hard to tell what's going on. You know, at the same time, we're requesting documents and we have to pay for these documents. And they're never like, no, we're not going to give these to you. Or, you know, whenever it's like this discussion we have with different government entities about obtaining these documents, they're never like, no, because you're not real journalists or whatever. I mean, I guess it doesn't matter because they're supposed to give them to anyone who will pay for them. So, yeah, I mean, it's all over the place and it's hard to say. You know, I don't necessarily feel, you know, I used to do organizing work before I started doing this project, and I don't necessarily feel any more or less safe now that I'm doing this like journalist work. And at Standing Rock, people would tell us that they actually are going to target us first. So like water protectors, indigenous water protectors are like, yeah, they're going to go after you first. So it's been like that. As far as documenting on unceded tribal land, that's a great question. I hadn't really thought about it. When we went to Standing Rock, we have our own tent. We don't have like a wrangler or anything. We wear press badges. Some other media entities wouldn't necessarily be able to do that. So, I mean, we were welcomed in a camp, treated really well by our neighbors. While I was there for a week, probably 40 or 50 people, both native and non-native, thanked me for the work that Unicorn Riot was doing. So as far as like when we're allowed to like document and where, that hasn't really come up yet. I hadn't really thought about it. If they told us, you know, hey, we don't want you to film, like there's certain instances where they don't want us to document certain songs that are sacred or prayers or do things, and you know, we respect that, and so we'll turn our cameras off, you know, if people tell us that. So
I would imagine you'd be a little safer if, or think about or redact or whatever, if you hypothetically were catching something that could be incriminating to an individual.
Yeah. Yeah. We can.
Yeah. Just kind of like off the deep end right here. My co-host was telling me last night about the drones that are up there that are blocking cell signal and other things. Is that a thing? Like law enforcement using drones to...
I would say, I was just reading something about last night. I don't have enough research to completely know like what's, you know, we've been trying to delve more into that and understand it. It all seems possible to me. I do know there were some signs around the camp just saying if you see a free Wi-Fi signal, do not jump on it. It's being used to fish, you know, just like this is not secure and it's being directly used by law enforcement. Seems like anything's possible at this point. I mean, we would lose signal as soon as we got into camp. I don't know what it was like beforehand. So it's definitely hard to say. I think there might be other people that have more information about that.
So my experience with the drones is that the drones I saw, most of them were actually from the camp. Like people in the camp have drones. Like there's digital smoke signals and drone to be wild is out there, and other people in the, I've never seen so many drones, so I'll tell you that. There are drones flying around all the time. It's hard to tell if they're from the camp or law enforcement's, but most of the ones I see are usually from our side. There is an FCC no-fly zone they continue to impose, but some of the people in the camp are indigenous and saying, hey, this is unceded land, so like we're going to fly a drone here. You know, and document this. So there's been that. There was a few days after the bridge standoff, a cell phone tower that was powered by solar panels did show up right outside the camp on, I think, like kind of more of the south end of the camp. We're not really sure who put that tower up. But all of a sudden after, you know, Lorenzo had been out there since April. And then all of a sudden, Lorenzo's on Verizon. All of a sudden, Lorenzo had signal. So, and had like a few bars, like a few days later. Now, you know, who did that? There's a lot of speculating. Like, you know, did the cops do it under the guise of safety? Did the uh, did some of the cell providers or all of them decide they need to put a tower out there because there's about 3,000 people out there when we were in camp, but now there could be twice that. You know, we're not really sure why that's going on. And there is a little bit of a faint signal if you go out there with a cell phone booster. They make them for like cars and trucks and like campers. You can actually get some okay signal. But, you know, the other thing too is that it depends on what provider you use. Like T-Mobile gets almost no signal out there. AT&T gets a little bit, and Verizon's like pretty good, but also the most expensive provider. So there's things like that. But I mean, it's remote out there. And a lot of people, there's also a lot of paranoia in the camp. So it's like, you know, hard to really say like what's going on. I mean, we would get report. We went to Bismarck on Thanksgiving to cover that action on our way back to camp. People are like, the cops are raiding the camp. Oh my God. We saw people on Twitter, like, I'm tweeting my husband that I love them and stuff. We get to camp and everything's normal, you know? So it was like, there's just a lot of paranoia. But now there is actually the coverage is still not very good, but it's better than it was because this cell phone tower, this solar powered cell phone tower appeared on the south end of camp.
Yeah. That's just bizarre.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the, you know, the government does use fake cell phone. I mean, like, even just on Muck Rock, here's the first story. Virginia yeah. State Police released cell phone surveillance logs because they set up a simulator like tower that's just collecting information on people, that's pinging people.
Yeah. And you know, and the other thing too is like, if they were using an ISMI catcher, your cell phone still wouldn't work. It would look like it's working, but I don't think they actually, a lot of those devices actually pass signal through. It seems like service is working. I mean, also like pretty much every internet service provider or mobile service provider does cooperate with the NSA. You know, people should try to use tools that's going to protect them from that anyway. So it's like all that stuff is being monitored anyways. And, you know, it'd probably be pretty easy for them to figure out, like, who's at the camp.
Yeah. Yeah, remember, listeners, do not assume any sort of safety over digital means.
Yeah. So. Absolutely.
But still, don't let that hamper, you know, doing what you need to do. Just work around it.
Yeah, exactly.
Take your battery out, whatever. Well, so how can folks follow Unicorn Riot's coverage of all these real-time, real in-depth struggles that are going on? And also, do you need contributors, or is it like a collective thing that you have to be like vouched in and stuff like that?
We do have to vouch people in, and right now we're trying to figure out kind of like how we're going to grow and in what way. But we do have contributors. I think soon here we're going to actually have an online kind of submit form thing where people can submit videos and stuff to us, but we're still working on that. Twitter is always where you're going to see our stuff breaking. So if you go to UR_ninja on Twitter, you can see what we're talking about. You can see our articles. And whenever we're about to start live streaming, we tweet. You can look at our live stream channel, Unicorn Riot, on livestream.com. We're on Facebook. And you can check out our website at unicornriot.ninja.
That's awesome. Well, Wendy and Pat, thank you both for taking the time to talk to me. And I've really enjoyed the conversation. And y'all do great work.
Thanks, Bruce. Thank you. You do too. I listen to your radio show like all the time.
Blushing again.
Oh, it's good to talk to you.
It's really good to talk to you too.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville, specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.